Wilson sat very still, eyes fixed on the Archbishop's face, and somewhere deep inside he felt a taut, singing tension. That tension rose, twisting higher and tighter, and his right hand wrapped its fingers around his pectoral scepter. "The reason for this meeting tonight is that the Brethren decided it would be best to share that same knowledge with you. Not the safest thing to do, perhaps, and not necessarily the wisest, but the best. The Brethren feel, as I do, that you deserve that knowledge, yet it's also a two-edged sword. There are dangers in what we're about to tell you, my son, and not just spiritual ones. There are dangers for us, for you, and for all the untold millions of God's children living on this world, or who may ever live upon it, and I fear it may bring you great pain. Yet I also believe it will ultimately bring you even greater joy, and in either case, I would never inflict it upon you if not for my deep belief that one of the reasons God sent you to Kairos in the first place was to receive exactly this knowledge." He paused, and Wilson drew a shaky breath. He looked around the other faces, saw the same solemnity in all of them, and a part of him wanted to stop the Archbishop before he could utter another word. There was something terrifying about the stillness, about those expressions, and he realized he believed every word Stainer had already said. Yet behind his terror, beyond the fear, lay something else. Trust. "If your purpose was to impress me with the seriousness of whatever you're about to tell me, Your Eminence, you've succeeded," he said after a moment, and felt almost surprised his voice didn't quiver around the edges. "Good," Caleb said, reclaiming the thread of the conversation, and Wilson's eyes went to the Emperor. "But before we get any further into this, there's one other person who needs to be party to the discussion." Wilson's eyebrows rose, but before he could frame the question, even to himself, the door between Stainer's spacious office and Ushire's much more humble adjoining cubicle opened, and a tall, blue-eyed man in the cuirass and chainmail of the Imperial Guard stepped through it. The intendant's eyes widened in shock and disbelief. Everyone in Tellisburg knew Merlin Athrawis had been sent to Zebediah and Coruscant to protect Empress Charlian and Crown Princess Alana. At that moment, he was almost 7,000 miles from Tellisburg Palace as a wyvern might have flown. He couldn't possibly be here. Yet he was.
"Good afternoon, Father Pater," Merlin said in his deep voice, one hand stroking his fierce mustachios. "As I told you once in King Harald's presence, I believe in God. I believe God has a plan for all men everywhere, and I believe it's the duty of every man and woman to stand and contend for light against the darkness. That was the truth, as you confirmed for yourself, but I'm afraid I wasn't able to tell you all the truth then. Today I can."
Pater Wilson's face was ashen, despite his deeply tanned complexion. Twilight had settled beyond the windows while Merlin, Caleb, and Stainer took turns describing the Journal of St. Zerno. The blows to Wilson's certainty had come hard and fast, and he knew now why Merlin was present. It was hard enough to believe the truth, even to accept that it might be the truth, with the Sagian sitting there watching his face in the Archbishop's office when Wilson had known he was thousands of miles away. Of course, the fact he's here doesn't necessarily prove everything they've just told you is the truth, Pater, does it? His Schulerite training demanded. The writ tells us there are such things as demons, and who but a demon could have made the journey Merlin claims to have made in this recon skimmer of his? Yet even as he asked himself that, he knew he didn't believe for a moment that Merlin was a demon. In many ways, he wished he did. Things would have been so much simpler,
and he would never have known his deep and abiding faith had been built entirely upon the most monstrous lie in human history, if only he'd been able to believe that. The priest in him, and the young seminarian he'd been even before he took his vows, cried out to turn away, to reject the lies of Shanwei's demon henchmen, before they completed the corruption of his soul, a corruption which must have begun well before this moment, if he could accept even for an instant that Merlin wasn't a demon. And he couldn't reject them as lies. That was the problem. He couldn't. And not just because of all those examples of technology Merlin's just demonstrated either, he thought starkly. All those doubts of yours, all those questions about how God could have permitted someone like Clintan to assume such power. They're part of the reason you believe every single thing these people have just told you. But all the things they've said still don't answer the questions. Unless the answer is simply so obvious, you're afraid to reach out and touch it. If it's all truly a lie, if there truly are no archangels and never were, then what if God himself was never anything but a lie? That would explain his permitting Clintan to murder and kill and maim in his name, wouldn't it? Because he wouldn't be doing anything of the sort, since he never existed in the first place.
I'm sorry, Father, Merlin said softly. I'm sorry we've had to inflict this on you. It's different for me. One thing my experience here on Safehold has taught me is that I'll never truly be able to understand the shock involved in having all that absolute, documented certainty snatched out from under you.
That's a very good way to describe it, actually, Sajin Merlin. Or should I call you Nimu Alban? The Archbishop and I have an ongoing argument about that, Merlin said with an odd, almost whimsical smile. To be honest, Father, I still haven't decided exactly what I really am. On the other hand, I've also decided there's no option but to continue on the assumption that I am Nimu Alban, or that she's a part of me, at any rate, because the life or death of the human species depends on the completion of the mission she agreed to undertake. Because of these gababa, Wilson pronounced the unfamiliar word carefully.
That's certainly the greatest, most pressing part of it, Merlin agreed. Sooner or later, humanity is going to encounter them again. If we do that without knowing what's coming, it's highly unlikely we'll be fortunate enough to survive a second time. But there's more to it than that, too. The society created here on Safehold is a straitjacket at best. At worst, it's the greatest intellectual and spiritual tyranny in history. We, all of us, Father Pater, including this pika sitting in front of you, have a responsibility, a duty, to break that tyranny. Even if there is no God, the moral responsibility remains. And if there is a God, as I believe there is, we have a responsibility to him as well.
Wilson stared at the pika, the machine, and he felt a sudden, almost irresistible need to laugh insanely. Merlin wasn't even alive, and yet he was telling Wilson he believed in God. And what was Wilson supposed to believe in now?
I know what you're thinking at this moment, Peter, Stenair said quietly.
Wilson's grey eyes snapped to him, wide with disbelief that anyone could truly know that. Yet that incredulity faded as he gazed into the Archbishop's face.
Not the exact words you're using to flagellate yourself, of course, Stenair continued. All of us find our own ways to do that. But I know the doubts, the sense of betrayal, of violation. All these years you've deeply and sincerely believed in the Holy Writ, in the testimonies, in Mother Church, in the archangels, and in God. You've believed, my son, and you've given your life to that belief.
and now you've discovered it all a lie, all built on deliberate fabrications for the express purpose of preventing you from ever reaching out to the truth. It's worse than being physically violated, because you've just discovered your very soul was raped by merely mortal men and women pretending to be gods, who died centuries before your own birth. He paused, and Wilson looked at him silently, unable to speak, and Stainer shook his head slowly.
I can't and won't try to dictate the right way to deal with what you're feeling at this moment, the Archbishop said quietly. That would violate my own most deeply held beliefs, but I will ask you to think about this. The Church of God Awaiting wasn't created by God. It was built by men and women. Men and women who had seen a more terrible tragedy than anything you and I could possibly imagine. Who had been broken and damaged by that experience, and who were prepared to do anything, anything at all, to prevent it from happening again. I believe they were terribly, horribly mistaken in what they did. Yet I've come to the conclusion over the years since I first discovered Saint Zerno's journal, and even more in the time since I've known Merlin and gained access to Owl's records of pre-Safeholdian history, that for all their unspeakable crimes, they weren't really monsters. Oh, they did monstrous things in plenty, and understanding the why can't excuse the what of their actions. I'm not trying to say it could, and I'm sure they did what they did for all the flawed personal motives we could imagine as well, including the hunger for power and the need for control. But that doesn't change the truth of the fact that they genuinely believed the ultimate survival of the human race depended upon their actions. Do I think that justifies what they did? No. Do I think it makes the final product of their lie any less monstrous? No. Am I prepared to close my eyes, turn away and allow that lie to continue unchallenged forever? 1,000 times no, but neither do I think they acted out of pure evil and self-interest. And neither do I believe anything they might have done indicts God. Remember that they built their lie not out of whole cloth, but out of bits and pieces they took away from the writings and the beliefs and the faith of thousands of generations which had groped and felt their way towards God without benefit of the unbroken, unchallenged, and untrue scripture and history which we possessed. And so I come to my final rhetorical question. Do I believe the fact that men and women made unscrupulous by desperation and terror misused and abused religion and God himself means God doesn't exist? 1,000,000 times no, my son. I can no longer prove that to you by showing you the incontrovertible, inviolable word set down by the immortal archangels. I can only ask you to reach inside yourself once more, to seek the wellsprings of faith, and to look at all the wonders of the universe, and all the still greater wonders which are about to become available to you, and decide for yourself. Merlin and I had a discussion about this very subject the night he and I first told Caleb the truth. I wasn't aware then that I was following in the footsteps of another, far more ancient philosopher when I asked him what I could possibly lose by believing in God. But now I ask you the same question, Pater. What do you lose by believing in a loving, compassionate God who's finally found a way to reach out to his children once more? Will it make you an evil man? Lead you into the same sort of actions that ensnared the real Langhorne and the real Bedard? Or will you continue to reach out in love to those about you? To do good when the opportunity to do good comes to you? To reach the end of your life, knowing you've truly labored to leave the world and all in it a better place than it might otherwise have been? And if there is no God,
If all there is beyond this life is a dreamless, eternal sleep, only nothingness, what will your faith have cost you then?
The Archbishop smiled suddenly.
Do you expect to feel cheated or swindled when you realize there was no God waiting beyond that threshold? Only two things can lie on the other side of death, Pater. It's what Merlin or Owl might describe as a binary solution set. There's either nothingness or some sort of continued existence, whether it leads us to what we think of now as God or not. And if it's nothingness, then whether or not you were cheated is meaningless. And if there is a continued existence which doesn't contain that whom I think of as God, then I'll simply have to start over learning the truth again, won't I?
Pater gazed at him for several more seconds, then drew a deep breath.
I don't know what to believe at this moment, Your Eminence, he said finally. I never imagined I could feel such turmoil as I'm feeling right now. Intellectually, I believe you when you say you've experienced the same things, and I can see you truly have found a way for your faith to survive those experiences. I envy that, I think. And the fact that I don't know whether I truly envy your certainty or resent it as yet another manifestation of the lie sums up the heart of my confusion. I'll need time, and a great deal of it, before I can put my spiritual house back in order and say, yes, this is where I stand.
Of course you will, Stainer said simply. Surely you don't think anyone else has ever simply taken this in stride and continued without missing a step?
I don't really know what I think right now, Your Eminence.
Wilson was astonished by the note of genuine humour in his own response.
Then you're about where everyone is at this point, Father, Merlin told him, and smiled with a bittersweet crookedness. And believe me, I may not have had to grapple with the knowledge that I've been lied to all my life, but waking up in Nemo's cave and realizing I'd been dead for the better part of 1,000 years was just a little difficult to process.
I can believe that, Wilson said, yet even as he spoke his eyes had darkened, and his expression turned grim.
What is it, Pater? Stainer asked quickly but softly,
and the intendant shook his head hard.
It's just ironic that Merlin should mention 1,000 years, he said.
You see, not everything about the archangels and Mother Church was set forth in the writ, or the testimonies, after all, Your Eminence.
3. A recon skimmer above Carter's Ocean.
Merlin Athrawis leaned back in his flight couch, gazing up through the canopy at the distant moon. The waters of Carter's Ocean stretched out far below him like an endless black mirror, touched with silver highlights. The stars were distant, glimmering pinpricks overhead, but ahead of him lay a wall of cloud, the back edge of a massive weather front, moving steadily eastward across Coruscant. It all seemed incredibly peaceful, restful even. It wasn't, of course. The winds along the leading edge of that front were less powerful than those which had battered Caleb further north, but they were quite powerful enough, and they were going to catch up with Dawn Star in the next few hours. The galleon and her escorts were passing through Corris Strait, about to enter Southreach Sound southeast of Coruscant, before looping back westward through Whitehorse Reach to the Coruscantian capital of Mantia. And Merlin wondered if the bad weather was going to be his ally or his comeuppance. Getting on and off a sailing ship in the middle of the ocean without being detected was a non-trivial challenge, even for a peeker. As it was, he'd officially retreated to his cabin to meditate, and Charlian and the rest of her guard detail would see to it that he wasn't disturbed. He'd even left a rope trailing helpfully from the galleon's sternwalk, so he could shinny back aboard, hopefully unnoticed. After so long, it had become almost a well-established routine.
Except, of course, that if the weather's as bad as it looks like being tonight, there are going to be people keeping an anxious watch on little things like rigging and sails or rogue waves, any one of whom might just happen to notice the odd seijin climbing up a rope out of the ocean in the middle of the night. His lips twitched at the thought. Yet he wasn't really worried about it. He'd be able to spot any lookout before the lookout could spot him, and a pika could easily spend an hour or two submerged in the ship's wake, clinging to a rope and waiting patiently until the coast was clear. Not only that, but he'd be back aboard several hours before local dawn, with plenty of darkness to help cover his return. In fact, that was the real reason for the timing of the conference with Father Pater. They'd had to make sufficient allowance for Merlin's transit, and he'd had to plan on both departing and returning under cover of night if he wanted to be certain he wasn't observed. "And that's exactly what you're going to be doing," he told himself. "So why don't you stop worrying about that, and start worrying about what Father Pater just told you instead?" His brief, almost smile disappeared, and he shook his head. "I guess fair's fair. You've cheerfully torn lots of other people's worlds apart by telling them the truth about Langhorne and Bedard. It's about time somebody returned the compliment." He closed his eyes, and his perfect pika's memory replayed the conversation in Michael Stainer's office. "What do you mean? Not everything about the archangels and Mother Church was set forth in the writ or the testimonies, my son?" Stainer asked, his eyes narrowing with concern, as Pater Wilson's tone registered. "I mean, there's more than one reason my family's always been so deeply involved in the affairs of Mother Church, Your Eminence." Wilson's face was tight, his voice harrowed with mingled bitterness, anger, and lingering shock at what he'd already been told. He looked around the others' faces and drew a deep breath. "The tradition of my family's always been that we were directly descended from the Archangel Shula," he said harshly. "All my life, that's been a source of great joy to me, and of a pride I've struggled against as something unbecoming in any son of Mother Church. And, of course, it was also something Mother Church and the Inquisition would flatly have denied could have been possible. That's one of the reasons my family was always so careful to keep the tradition secret. But we were also specifically charged to keep it so, according to the tradition, when certain knowledge was left in our possession." Merlin's mollycirc nerves tingled with sudden apprehension, but he kept his face expressionless as he cocked his head. "May I assume your possession of the Stone of Shula was part of that tradition and knowledge, Father?" "Indeed you may." The bitterness in Wilson's tone was joined by corrosive anger. "All my life I've believed this." He lifted his pectoral scepter, the disguised reliquary which concealed the relic his family had treasured for so long. "Had been left as a sign of God's approval, of our faithfulness," he snorted harshly. "Except, of course, that it's nothing of the sort." "I don't know why it was left with you, Father," Merlin said gently. "I'm pretty sure whoever handed it to your ancestors, and it may actually have been Shula for all we know, didn't have any particular faith in God. From what I've heard about your history, though, that hasn't kept your family from believing in him. As for what the Stone of Shula actually is, it's what was called a verifier. Once upon a time, it might have been called a lie detector instead. And however it came into your possession, Father, it truly does do what your ancestors were told it did. It tells you whether or not someone is telling you the truth. In fact," he smiled wryly, "it's a full-spectrum verifier. Which means it can also tell when a pika is telling you the truth," which required a certain circumspection, "when I answered the questions you once put to me in King Harald's throne room."
Given what you've just told me about Safehold's true history, I'd say that was probably an understatement, Wilson replied, with the first thing like a true smile he'd produced in the last hour or two.
Oh, it was, Merlin nodded.
At the same time, what I told you then was the truth, exactly as it insisted.
I believe that, Wilson said quietly. What I'm struggling with is whether or not I should believe anything else I once thought was true.
There was silence for a moment. Then the young man in the Schulerite cassock shook himself.
I'm going to have to deal with that, I know that. But I also understand why you have to be leaving shortly, Merlin, so I suppose I'd better get on with it.
He drew a deep breath, visibly bracing himself, then sat back in his chair and folded his hands in his lap. When I was a boy, my father and Uncle Howard told me all the tales about our family's history and the role we'd played in the vicarate and in Mother Church's history. Or I thought they told me all the tales, at any rate. It was enough to make me realize we had a special, joyous duty, and it helped me understand why my family had stood for reform, held tight to the truth for so many centuries. Why we'd made so many enemies as corruption set deeper and deeper into the vicarate. The voice of conscience seldom makes comfortable hearing, and never less comfortable than to those who know deep in their hearts how far short of their duties and their responsibilities they've fallen. All of the orders teach that, and it was enough, I thought then, to explain everything. Yet it wasn't until I'd graduated from seminary and been ordained that Father told me the complete truth about our family and our traditions. That was when he showed me the Stone of Shula and the key. He paused, and Merlin's eyebrows quirked. He looked quickly at the others and saw the same expression looking back at him. Then all of them returned their attention to the young priest.
The key, Father, Merlin prompted.
According to the secret history Father showed me, the key and the stone were both left in our possession by the Archangel Shula himself. The stone you know about. The key must be another piece of your technology, Sajin Merlin, although it's less spectacular at first glance than the stone. It's a small sphere, flattened on one side and about this far across. He held up thumb and forefinger, perhaps 2 inches apart, which looks like plain, polished steel. His lips flickered in a small smile. In fact, it's so plain, generations of Wilsons have hidden it in plain sight by using it as a paperweight. There was a ghost of genuine humor in his voice, and Merlin felt himself smiling back, but then Wilson continued. By itself, the key really is nothing but a paperweight, he said soberly. But in conjunction with the stone, it becomes something else. The best way I can describe it is as a repository of visions. Merlin straightened in his chair, his expression suddenly intent.
Father, I never had the opportunity to actually examine the stone. I just assumed that it filled only a small section of your scepter's staff. But it doesn't, does it?
No, it doesn't, Wilson confirmed. It fills almost the full length of the staff, and it can be removed. When it is, it mates to the key. Its lower end clings unbreakably to the flat face of the key, as if they've become one, and they can be released from one another only by someone who knows the proper command. His eyes watched Merlin carefully. Should I assume you know how it works and why?
I'd have to examine both of them to be certain, Merlin replied, but I'm reasonably sure that among the instructions your family was left was a ritual, which regularly exposed the stone to direct sunlight.
Wilson nodded, and Merlin shrugged.
What that was doing, Father, was to charge, to empower the stone. In time, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. For the moment, Simply accept that there's nothing demonic or divine in the process. It's a simple matter of physics. At any rate, what you're calling the key is a memory module, a solid chunk of molecular circuitry. You could fire it out of a cannon without hurting it, and that single sphere you've described could easily contain all the knowledge in all the libraries of the entire Carisian Empire with space left over. The problem is getting it out, and for that you need a power source. So, I'm reasonably sure that when you remove the stone entirely from the scepter, the length of it that mates to the key doesn't glow the way the rest of it does, right? Correct, Wilson nodded. Of course it doesn't, Merlin shook his head. That's the adapter, Father. It takes the energy you've stored in the stone and feeds it to the memory module. And when it does, the module projects images, doesn't it? That's precisely what it does, Wilson said grimly. And if you hadn't demonstrated your comm and its ability to generate holograms, I would never have believed a word any of you told me. Because, you see, I've seen the image of the Holy Shula himself. I've heard his voice. Until this very day, I've believed, deeply and truly believed, that my family and I had been directly touched by the very finger of God, and I'd still believe that, if you hadn't just shown me exactly the same sort of vision which has lied to my family for 9 centuries. Merlin sat silent for a long, still moment. It had never occurred to him that anyone associated with the temple might possess such an artifact. Yet now that he knew, he also realized the blow the truth had delivered to Pater Wilson was even crueler than anything it had done to anyone else. The young Shularite's faith had been so sure, so total, because he had known he'd been in the very presence of God, or in the presence of one of God's archangels, at least. Now he knew how bitterly betrayed he and all his family had actually been. Knew his father and uncle had gone to their deaths, seduced and lied to by the very vision which had lied to him as well. In that moment, Merlin's own soul cried out against what had been done, what he had done, to Pater Wilson. How could any mortal being be expected to deal with something like this? How could any faith, any belief, not be twisted into something bitter and cold and hateful after the realization of a betrayal so profound, so complete and so personal? My son, Michael Stainer said quietly into the silence, his expression sad. I understand the reasons for your pain. I doubt I can truly imagine its depth, but I understand its cause. And I believe I can at least imagine the extent to which you must now question all you ever knew or ever believed, not just about the church, and not just about the archangels, but about everything. About yourself, about God, about how much of the vocation you felt was solely the result of deception, about how you could have been so stupid as to be deceived, and how so many generations of your family could have dedicated themselves, sacrificed themselves, to the lie you've just discovered. It can be no other way. Wilson looked at him, and the Archbishop shook his head gently. My son, Pater, I will never fault you if you decide all of it was a lie, and that God does not and never did exist. After discovering a deception such as this, it would take an archangel not to lash out in the bitterness and the fury it so justly awakened within you. And if that happens, you must never blame yourself for it either. If you decide God doesn't exist, then you must not punish yourself in the stillness of your own mind for turning away from all that you were taught to believe and revere. I hope and pray that won't happen.
The depth and strength of the faith I've seen out of you is too great for me to want to see it cast away for any reason, but I would rather see it discarded cleanly than see you trying to force a life into it when it no longer has pulse or breath of its own. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?" Wilson looked back at the Archbishop for several seconds, then nodded slowly. "I think so, Your Eminence," he said slowly. "And I'm not sure what's going to happen. You're right that I now know the faith which has carried me so far has been only the shadow cast by a direct and personal lie. Yet that's true of all of us, I suppose, isn't it? My lie's been more spectacular than that of others, but all of us have been lied to. So in the final analysis, what I have to determine is whether it's the way in which the lie is transmitted or the lie itself which truly matters, and whether a lie can still contain even the tiniest grain of truth."
"If it's any consolation, my son," Stainer said with a crooked smile, "the writ wasn't the first holy book to say that faith grows like a mustard seed. God works from tiny beginnings to great ends. I hope you're right, Your Eminence. Or I think I do. It's going to be a while before I can decide whether or not I want my faith to survive, I'm afraid."
"Of course it is," Stainer said simply. Wilson nodded, then turned back to Merlin. "At any rate, Merlin, your description of how the key works was accurate. When Father showed it to me, it projected images, visions, holograms, of the Archangel Schuler himself, instructing us in our family's responsibilities." He frowned thoughtfully. "I sometimes think that was one reason my family's always supported a gentler approach for the Inquisition. The Schuler of the Key isn't the grim and terrible Schuler who prescribed the question and the punishment. Stern, yes, but without the demeanour of someone who could demand such hideous punishment for a child of God who was merely mistaken."
"I never knew the real Schuler," Merlin said. "Nemu may have met him, but if so, it was after she'd recorded me." He smiled sadly. "Because of that, I've never seen any reason not to assume the Book of Schuler was written by the Archangel Schuler. But we really don't have confirmation of the authorship of any of the books of the writ when you come down to it. For that matter, the Book of Schuler wasn't part of the original, early copy of the writ Commodore Pei left in Nemu's cave. The entire thing was extensively reworked after Langhorne took out the Alexandrian enclave. Inevitably, I suppose. And the Book of Schuler and the Book of Chihiro were both added. I don't know if it's any consolation, Father, but it really is possible. The actual Schuler never wrote the book credited to him, and if he didn't, then he isn't the author of the question and the punishment either."
"I would like to believe that was the case," Wilson said softly after a moment. "I'd like to believe not everything I thought I knew was a lie. And if it's true my family actually is descended from the real Schuler, it would ease my heart to know he wasn't capable of decreeing such hideous penalties in defense of a religion he knew was nothing but a lie." He was silent again for a moment. Then he gave himself a shake. "However that may be," he continued more briskly, "what my family's referred to as the vision of the Archangel Schuler for so long as we can remember instructs us not simply in our duty to keep Mother Church untainted, without stain, focused on her great mission in the world, but also charges us with a special responsibility. A key within the key, as it were."
"I beg your pardon?" Merlin asked.
"There's a chamber under the temple," Wilson told him. "I've never actually been there, but I've seen it in the vision. I know the way to it, and I can picture it in my mind's eye even now. And within that chamber is an altar. one with god lights set into its surface. There are also two handprints, one each for a right and a left hand on either side of a small circular recess. According to the vision, if one, truly dedicated to God and his plan, places the key in that recess, and his hands in those imprints and calls upon Shula's name, the power of God himself will awaken to defend Mother Church in her hour of need. Merlin felt the heart he no longer had stop beating. According to the vision, it may be done only once, and only in the hour of Mother Church's true need, Wilson continued. Knowing Father and Uncle Horwood, there's no way they would have viewed the reformist movement as a genuine threat to Mother Church. The Church of Caris has made no demands which actually conflict with the writ in any way, and they would have realized that as well as I do. I'm sure the schism distressed them deeply, and that both of them were profoundly concerned about the implications for the unity of God's church and plan, but the temple would have had to be threatened with actual physical invasion before either of them would have felt the time had come to awaken God's power in the church's defense. There's no doubt in my mind that both of them agreed with the reformists' indictments of the vicarate, and believed the reformists were truer sons of God than the group of four could ever be. I don't know where that would have led them in the end, but there's no way they would have presumed to beseech God to strike down men and women they believed were simply attempting to live the lives and the faith God had ordained for them from the beginning. The others were all looking at Merlin, and Caleb cleared his throat. "Is that altar what I'm afraid it is?" he asked carefully. "I don't know, but it certainly could be," Merlin said unhappily. "I don't know what would happen if someone obeyed Shula's commands. It might simply trigger some sort of reaction out of the bombardment platform. Or, for that matter, one of the things I've been afraid of for some time is that Langhorne, or whoever built the temple after Langhorne was dead, could have included an AI in the master plan. Something like Owl, but probably with more capacity. Only I'd decided that couldn't be the case, because if there were an AI monitoring what the vicarate's been up to for the last 2 or 3 centuries, it probably would have already intervened. But if there's something like that down there that's on standby, waiting for a human command to wake it up." His voice trailed off, and Caleb, Stainer, and Wagner looked at one another tautly. "I have far too little grasp of this technology you've described to even guess whether or not there's an AI involved," Wilson said. "I only know that if the vision is telling the truth and the ritual is properly performed, something will respond." "But no one beyond your family even knows about the ritual," Caleb asked, and Wilson shrugged. "To the best of my knowledge, no, Your Majesty. On the other hand, so far as I know, none of the other families of the vicarate were aware of what my family knew either. We always believed, on the basis of what the vision told us, that we'd been chosen, singled out as the only guardians of that chamber and altar. But there may have actually been others. The stone's existence was known, of course, although most people believe it was lost forever at St. Everhard's death. So far as we knew, no one else had ever been informed of the key's existence, although in more recent years, Father came to fear from some things he had heard that perhaps someone else did know at least something about the key and the stone's continued existence. He never said who that someone might be, but I know he was concerned by the possibility of one or both of them falling into hands which might well misuse them." "I wish we could get our hands on that damned key," Merlin said forcefully, and Wilson surprised him with a chuckle. "What?" Merlin's eyes narrowed. "I said something funny?" "No," Wilson said. "But when I said Father and Uncle Horwood wouldn't have petitioned God to strike the reformists, I suppose I should really have said that they couldn't have." When Father suggested I should take the post as Archbishop Eric's intendant here in Kairos, he sent me on my way, at least in part, to keep certain things out of Clintan's reach. With the stone, of course, but also with a family keepsake. A paperweight. "The key is here in Kairos?" Caleb demanded. "Sitting on the corner of my desk in the patent office, Your Majesty," Wilson confirmed.
"With your permission, Father, I'd like to have one of Al's remotes collect that from you and take it back to Nemu's cave, where we can examine it properly," Merlin said, watching Wilson's face carefully.
"Of course you have my permission. Not that I imagine there's much I could do to stop you," Wilson replied with a half-smile. Then his expression sobered once more. "Just as I'm reasonably confident that if it turns out you were ill-advised to tell me the truth about the church and the archangels, there wouldn't be much I could do to stop you from correcting your error." The silence was sudden and intense, lingering until Wilson himself broke it with a small, dry chuckle. "I'm an inquisitor, a Schulerite," he said. "Surely you didn't imagine I could hear what you've told me and not recognize what you'd have to do if you thought I might betray you. I'm sure all of you, especially you, Your Eminence, would deeply regret the necessity, but I'm also sure you'd do it. And if you're telling me the truth, which I believe you are, you'd have no choice."
"I hope you won't be offended by this, Father, but at this particular moment you remind me rather strongly of Prince Narmon," Merlin said.
"Yes, I'm sure it would have occurred to the prince as well," Wilson said thoughtfully. "And to his wife, too," Caleb said. "I think she's just as smart as he is, and she hasn't lived with him that long without recognizing necessity when she sees it. All I can tell you is that at this moment I feel no inclination to betray your confidence, Your Majesty," Wilson shrugged. "Obviously, I'm still in something of a state of shock. I don't know how I'm going to feel about it tomorrow or the next day. I will promise this, however. Archbishop Michael's always extended me his trust, and I won't abuse that now. With your permission, Your Eminence, I request permission to withdraw to St. Zernos again for the next 5 days or so. I truly do need to spend some time in meditation and thought, for obvious reasons." He grimaced. "But I'd also like the opportunity to examine St. Zerno's journal for myself, and to spend some additional time speaking with Father Zon and the rest of the brethren who've grappled with the same issues rather longer than I have. That should keep me out of the public eye while I do some grappling of my own, which will also spare you the necessity of returning me to the genteel confinement I enjoyed immediately after Archbishop Eric's departure for the temple. It was never my intention to lock you up while you considered all the implications, Father," Stainer said. "With all due respect, Your Eminence, it should have been," Wilson said bluntly. "You've taken chances enough letting a convinced and believing Schulerite so close to you and to the levers of power here in the Empire. Until you know, until we all know, including myself, which direction the disillusioned Schulerite is going to go, you really can't afford to take any more chances. The amount of damage I could do to your cause with a few careless words, far less if I choose to lash out in my anger, and I am angry, Your Eminence, never doubt it, would be incalculable."
"I'm afraid he has a point, Michael," Caleb said. "I have to admit I'm a lot happier with the notion of a voluntary, let's call it seclusion instead of confinement on his part, than I'd be with the notion of clapping him into a cell somewhere. But he does have a point."
"Very well, my son," Stainer said heavily. "And I'm sure those remotes of yours will keep an eye on me as well, Sajin Merlin," Wilson said wryly. "But not when you're closeted with Father Zon or any of the others, Father," Merlin murmured, and the young priest laughed. "I'll bear that in mind," he said. Then his expression sobered once more. You asked whether there might be another key or its equivalent, and I said I thought not. I still think that's probably the case. And if it is, then presumably you don't have to worry about someone deliberately awakening whatever might lie under the temple. But there's a reason I said your comment about having been dead for almost 1,000 years was ironic, Merlin.
And that reason was? Merlin asked slowly. Because, according to the vision of Shula, Wilson said softly, the archangels themselves will return 1,000 years after the creation, to be sure Mother Church continues to serve the true plan of God.
Merlin blinked as his memory finished replaying the conversation, and the same chill ran through him once again. He had always been afraid of those power sources under the temple. He thought he wanted nothing more than to discover the truth about them. Now, he realized, the reality might be even worse than he'd allowed himself to imagine.
The archangels will return, he thought. What the hell does that mean? Were those lunatics crazy enough to put a batch of archangels into cryo under there? Were they actually willing to trust the cryo systems to keep them going that long? And even if they were, could the systems stand up for that many years?
So far as he knew, no one had ever used the cryo-suspension systems for a period greater than 30 or 40 years. Theoretically, they were supposed to be good for up to a century and a half, but 9 centuries.
But maybe that's not what it is after all.
Maybe it is an AI. It could be that they didn't trust an AI to run continuously, but were willing to let it come up periodically.
Only if that's the case, why wait 1,000 years before it makes its first check? Unless the vision of Shula is lying, and whatever it is, has actually been popping up for a look every 50 or 60 years, I suppose. Except that it's pretty evident the vicarate's been departing from the image of the church laid down in the Holy Writ for at least 200 or 300 years.
So if there's an AI down there that's supposed to be making mid-course adjustments, why has it kept its mouth shut? Unless it's broken. And that doesn't seem likely, given how many of the temple's other systems still seem to be up and running. I can't imagine they'd have built the place without making certain something as critical as monitoring AI would be the last thing to go down, not the first.
He grimaced, then froze as another thought struck him. I'm the only Pika Commodore Pei and the others had access to, an icy mental voice said. But what if I'm not the only Pika that came to Safehold after all? What if that's what's down there? The only reason I'm capable of long-term operation is because Dr. Proctor hacked my basic software. It's possible they could have brought along, hell, even built after they got here. Despite Langhorne's anti-technology lunacy, a Pika or two of their own. And if they didn't have Proctor's fine touch on the software, their Pikas could be limited to the legal 10 days of autonomous operation before their personalities and memories automatically dump. So maybe, if that's the case, it would make sense for them to only spin up once every 1,000 years or so. They get up, spend a day or two looking around, and if everything's humming along, they go back into shutdown immediately. For that matter, they could have multiple Pikas stashed down there in the cellar. One of them wakes up and looks around, and if there's a problem, he's got reinforcements he can call up. Hell, for that matter, if they did have more than one Pika down there and it was keyed to the same person, could he bootstrap himself back and forth between them to get around the 10-day limit? He didn't know the answer to his own question. Under the Federation's restrictions on personality-integrated cybernetic avatars, each Pika had been unique to the human being who owned it. It had been physically impossible for anyone else to operate it, and just as it had been illegal for a Pika to operate for more than 10 days in autonomous mode, it had been illegal for an individual even to operate, far less own, more than a single pika, except under strenuously controlled circumstances, which usually had to do with high-risk industrial processes or something similar. So far as he was aware, no one had ever attempted to simply shuttle someone's memories and personality back and forth between a pair of identical pikas keyed to the same owner-operator. He had no idea how the software's built-in restrictions would react to that, but it was certainly possible it would represent a lower-risk solution than Proctor's hack of his own software. Assuming one had access to multiple pikas, of course. And didn't that lead to an interesting speculation?
Owl?
Yes, Lieutenant Commander Alban? The distant AI replied. Could we use the fabrication unit in the cave to build another pika? That question requires refinement, Lieutenant Commander Alban.
What?
Merlin blinked at the unexpected response.
What sort of refinement?
List the difficulties. Theoretically, the fabrication unit could construct a pika, the AI said. It would deplete certain critical elements below the minimum inventory level specified in my core programming, which would require human override authorization. In addition, however, it would require data not available to me.
What sort of data are we talking about?
I do not have detailed schematics or design data on pikas.
You don't?
Merlin's eyebrows rose in surprise. No, Lieutenant Commander Alban, Al replied, and Merlin reminded himself not to swear when the AI stopped there, obviously satisfied with its response.
Why not?
He asked after a moment. Because it was never entered into my database. Merlin began reciting the names of the Federation's presidents to himself. Obviously, it had never been entered into Al's database. Of course, that wasn't the why he had had in mind when he posed the question. Why was it never entered into your database? He asked finally. And if you don't have a definitive answer, speculate. I do not have a definitive answer, Lieutenant Commander Alban. However, I would speculate that it was never entered because the construction of pikas was a highly specialized enterprise attended by a great many legal restrictions and security regulations and procedures. It would not be something that would be found in a general database. Certainly it would not be part of a tactical computer's database, nor apparently part of the library database downloaded from Romulus.
Damn. That does make sense, Merlin muttered.
Owl predictably made no reply. Merlin grimaced, but he was actually just as happy to be left to his thoughts for the moment. The possibility of building additional pikas had never occurred to him before. On the other hand, if he could, and if the additional pikas software duplicated his own, he could create clones of himself, which would be hugely helpful. Not only would it allow him to be in more than one place simultaneously, it would give him the advantage of redundancy if one of him inadvertently did something to which some high-tech watchdog system might take exception.
And if Wilson's right about something returning in 1,000 years, I may just need all the reinforcements I can get. He thought grimly. This is the year 895, but they've numbered their years of God from the end of Shanwei's rebellion, from the time the Church of God turned into the Church of God Awaiting. The day of creation was 70 years, standard years, not Safeholdian ones before that, and that makes this year 979 since the creation, which means we've got 20 years, give or take, before whatever's going to happen happens. 20 years might sound like a lot, but not when it was all the time they had to break not simply the Church of God Awaiting's political supremacy, but also its stranglehold on Safehold's religious and technological life.
They've been working on it for 5 years already, and all they'd really managed so far was to stave off defeat. Well, they'd begun gnawing away at the prescriptions of Zhou Zheng, slowly and very, very cautiously, but they certainly hadn't found a way to take the war to the church and the group of four on the mainland. And even if they managed that, simply defeating the group of four militarily wasn't going to miraculously undo 10 centuries' belief in the Holy Writ and the Archangels. That fight was going to take far longer, and it was likely to involve even more bloodshed than the current conflict. Perhaps still worse, if there was something Archangel, AI, or Pika waiting to wake up under the temple. He had to assume any technological advancement beyond the simple steam engines, which still hadn't attracted the bombardment system's attention to the castaway islands, was going to be noticed by its sensors and reported to the temple. At which point, it was entirely possible the wake-up schedule might be rather drastically revised. Owl, could analysis of this Pika give you the data you'd require to build additional ones? Probability of success would approach unity, assuming a complete analysis of software and hardware, the AI replied. And would such an analysis constitute a risk to this Pika's continued operation? Preliminary analysis indicates a 65-70% probability it would be rendered permanently inoperable, Owl said calmly. Why? Most probable cause would be failure of the unit's software. There is a significant probability that the necessary analysis would trigger a reboot, which would wipe the unit's current memory and personality. What if it were possible to reload the memory and personality from another source? In that case, the probability of rendering the current unit inoperable would drop to approximately 28%. Still that high? Merlin frowned. Why? In the event of a reboot, standard protocols would reinstall original program and system defaults, Lieutenant Commander. The software alteration which permits this unit's indefinite operation lies far outside those defaults and would be eliminated in such an eventuality, thus restoring the 10-day limitation on autonomous operation. Merlin grimaced. That made sense, he supposed, and 28% was still unacceptably high, under the current circumstances at least. But if circumstances changed... Do you have the capability out of existing resources to build both a Class 2 VR and a recording unit? He asked. Affirmative, Lieutenant Commander Alban. In that case, get started on both of them immediately. I assume you can run up the recording unit first. Affirmative, Lieutenant Commander Alban. Then send it out to me as soon as it's finished, he grimaced again. I might as well get myself recorded as soon as possible. Acknowledged, Lieutenant Commander Alban. June, Year of God, 895. 1. Siddhar City, Republic of Siddharmak. Don't be such a greedy guts, Burke Raymond scolded as the wyvern swooped down and snatched the morsel of fresh bread from his fingers. There's plenty if you just behave yourselves. The triumphant wyvern only whistled smugly at him and flapped its way back up onto the green-budded branch of the apple tree from which it had launched its pounce. It seemed remarkably unmoved by his appeal to its better nature, Burke reflected, and tore another piece from the loaf. He shredded it into smaller pieces, scattering them across the flagstone terrace for the less aggressive of his winged diners, then picked up a wedge of sharp cheddar cheese from the plate beside the bowl of grapes. He leaned back in his rattan chair, propping his heels on the matching chair which faced him on the other side of the table, and nibbled as he enjoyed the cool northern sunlight. It wasn't much like home, he thought, gazing out across the sparkling waters of North Bedard Bay. The locals, a label which he still had trouble applying to himself, usually called it simply North Bay, to distinguish it from the even larger Bedard Bay to the south. This far north of the equator, the seasons stood on their heads, and even late spring and early summer were almost uncomfortably cool to his Carisian blood. Trees were much later to leaf, flowers were later to bloom, and less colourful when they did, and ocean water was far too cold for a Carisian boy to swim in. Besides, he missed Telesberg's livelier waterfront, sharper-edged theatres, and heady, bustling air of intellectual ferment. Of course, that intellectual ferment was the main reason he was sitting here on his grandfather's Siddar City terrace, feeding bread to greedy wyverns and squabbling seagulls. It wasn't like, "So here you are," a familiar voice said, and he looked over his shoulder, then rose with a smile of welcome for the silver-haired, plump, but distinguished-looking woman who had just stepped out of the mansion's side door behind him. "I wasn't exactly hiding, Grandmother," he pointed out. "In fact, if you'd opened a window and listened, I'm sure you could have tracked me down without any trouble at all." He pulled one of the chairs away from the table with one hand, while the other gestured at the guitar lying in its open case on the bench beside him. "For that matter, if you'd only looked out the window, the fleeing birds and the small creatures running for the shrubbery with their paws over their ears would have pinpointed me for you." "Oh, nonsense, Burke," she laughed, patting him on the cheek before she seated herself in the proffered chair. "Your playing's not that bad." "Just not that bad?" he teased, raising one eyebrow at her. "Is that another way of saying it's almost that bad?" "No, that's what your grandfather would call it if he were here," Samantha Raymond replied. "And he'd mean just as little of it as I would. Go ahead and play something for me now, Burke." "Well, if you insist," he said in a long, suffering tone. She made a face at him, and he laughed as he picked the guitar back up. He thought for a moment, picking random notes as he considered, then struck the opening chord of The Way of the Widowmaker, one of the very first ballads he had learned to play, sitting on Samantha's lap. The sad, rich notes spilled across the terrace, while the sunlight struck chestnut highlights in his brown hair, and the wind ruffled that hair, sighed in the branches of the ornamental fruit trees, and sent the shrubbery sprays of blossoms flickering in light and shadow. He bent his head, eyes half closed, giving himself to the ballad, and his grandmother drew her steel thistle-silk wrap closely about her shoulders. She knew he thought of his music as a rich young man's hobby, but he was wrong. It was far more than that. As she watched him play, her own eyes lost some of their usual sparkle, darkening while the lament for lost sailors spilled up from his guitar strings to circle and curtsy around the terrace. It was a haunting melody, as lovely as it was sad, and she remembered how he had insisted she'd teach it to him when he'd been barely 7 years old. The year before, his parents' deaths had sent him to her more as her youngest son than her oldest grandson. "I don't suppose you could have thought of anything more depressing, could you?" she teased gently when the final note had faded away, and he shrugged. "I don't really think of it as depressing," he said, laying the guitar back in the case and running a fingertip gently down the bright strings. He looked back up at her. "It's sad, yes, but not depressing, Grandmother. There's too much love for the sea in it for that." "Perhaps you're right," she conceded. "Of course I am. I'm the poet, remember?" he smiled infectiously. "Besides," his smile turned warmer, gentler, "I love it because of who it was that taught it to me." "Flatterer!" She reached out and smacked him gently on the knee. "You got that from your father, and he got it from your grandfather." Really?
He seemed astounded by the notion and gazed thoughtfully out across the gleaming blue water for several seconds, then nodded with the air of someone who had just experienced a revelation.
So that's how someone with the Ryman nose got someone as good-looking as you to marry him. I'd always wondered about that, actually. You, Burke Rayman, are what was known in my youth as a rapscallion. Oh, no, Grandmother, you wrong me. I'm sure the term you'd really have applied to me would have been much ruder than that.
She laughed and shook her head at him, and he offered her the bowl of grapes. She selected one and popped it into her mouth, and he set the bowl down in front of her.
Somehow the hothouse grapes just aren't as good, he commented. They make me miss our vineyards back home.
He glanced back out across the bay as he spoke, and missed the shadow that flitted through her eyes. Or he could pretend he had, at least.
I think they have a lower sugar content, she said out loud, no sign of that shadow touching her voice.
That's probably it, he agreed, looking back at her with another smile. She returned the smile, plucked another grape, and leaned back, cocking her head to one side.
And what's this about you being off to Madame Parsons again this evening? She asked lightly. I hear you have at least a dozen rivals for her affections, you know.
Alas, too true. He pressed the back of his wrist to his forehead, his expression tragic.
That cretin Rafe Alexin offered her a sonnet last night, and he actually had the gall to make it a good one.
He shook his head.
Quickly, Grandmother, tell me what to do to recover in her eyes.
Oh, I'm sure you'll come about, she shook her head at him. Although, at the rate she seems to attract fresh suitors, you may yet find yourself crowded out.
Grandmother, he looked at her affectionately, I enormously admire Madame Parsons. I also think she's one of the most beautiful women I've ever met, and bearing in mind my paternal grandmother's youthful beauty, that's a pretty high bar for anyone to pass. Even more important, I've never met anyone more brilliant and cultured than she is. But she's also somewhere around twice my age, and I think she regards me more in the light of a puppy who hasn't yet grown into his ears and feet than anything remotely like a paramour. I promise, I'm on my very best behaviour at her soirees.
Of course you are, I know that, she said, just that bit too quickly, and he laughed and shook a finger under her nose.
Oh, no, you don't know it, he scolded. What a fibber! You're worried your darling grandson is going to be so enamoured of the gorgeous, sophisticated older woman that he's going to commit some indiscretion with her.
He shook his head, brown eyes glinting devilishly.
Trust me, Grandmother. When I commit youthful indiscretions, I'll take great care to make certain you know nothing about them. That way you'll be happy, and I'll remain intact.
You're right. Rapscallion is definitely too polite a term for you, young man. Her lips quivered as she fought to restrain a smile, and he laughed again.
Which is why you're afraid of those youthful indiscretions of mine, he observed. A charming, unprincipled rogue and general all-round ne'er-do-well is far more likely to succeed in being indiscreet, I imagine.
That must be it, she agreed. But you are going to be out again this evening? He looked a question at her, and she shrugged.
Your grandfather and I have invitations to the theatre tonight. They're presenting a new version of Yerdan's Flower Maiden, and I just wanted to know whether we should include you in the party.
It's tempting, he said. That's always been my favourite of Yerdan's plays, but I think I'll pass, if you and Grandfather won't be offended. I don't think it's going to be up to the Royal Company's production. Remember the last time we saw it at the Round? I doubt they'll be able to match that here in Siddar City.
Perhaps not, she shrugged lightly. It is an easy play to get wrong, I'll admit, she went on, deliberately not addressing his reference to the Round Theatre, the epicentre of the performing arts back home in Tellisburg.
And your grandfather and I won't be at all offended by the thought that you prefer a younger, livelier set of companions for the evening. Go, have a good time. I'm sure I will. And I promise, no indiscretions. He gave her a wink, closed the guitar case, kissed her cheek, and headed off into the townhouse whistling. She watched him go with a smile, but the smile faded, as his whistling did, and she looked back out across the bay with a far more pensive expression. Despite Ava Parsan's indisputable beauty, Samantha Raymond had never cherished the least fear Burke might become amorously involved with her. For that matter, she wouldn't have been terribly concerned if he had. Madame Parsan was as cultured as she was lovely. If anyone would have known how to take a young lover's ardour, treat it with gentleness, and send it on its way undamaged in the fullness of time, it would be she. And she was also wealthy enough for Samantha to be certain she couldn't possibly cherish any designs upon the Raymond family fortune. In fact, Samantha would actually have preferred for her grandson's interest in her to have been far more romantically focused than she feared it was. She hadn't been entirely honest with Burke about her husband's probable reaction to his destination for the evening either. Clayton Raymond hadn't shaken the dust of Tellisburg from his feet lightly when he moved his entire household and all of his business investments from Caris to the Republic of Sidamark. Clayton was a Carisian to his toenails, but he was also a man who took his principles seriously and a devout son of Mother Church. When it came time to choose between heretical crown and orthodox church, principles and belief alike had driven the inevitable outcome. His stature among Caris's mercantile elite, his wealth, and the fact that he had sacrificed so much of that wealth in the process of moving it from Tellisburg to Cedar City's Carisian quarter, gave him a standing second to none in the Carisian emigre community. Yet he himself remained trapped between his two worlds. Despite his horror at the Church of Caris's open break with the Grand Vicar, he remained too much a Carisian not to argue that the kingdom had been grievously provoked. One sin couldn't justify another, in his view, but neither would he condemn Caris's initial reaction to a totally unprovoked and unjustified onslaught. He'd fully supported King Harald's decision to fight in self-defense. It was King Caleb's actions he could not condone. Not that he blamed Caleb entirely. Harald's premature death had brought Caleb to the throne too early, in Clayton's view, and the new king had found himself in a desperately dangerous position. It had been his job to protect his people. No one could dispute that. And he'd been too young, too susceptible to the pressures of his advisers and counselors when it came to doing that job. The true culprits were Michael Stainer and the Duke of Grey Harbour, who had pushed Caleb into supporting open schism instead of at least trying to make a respectful appeal to the Grand Vicar's justice first. From there to the creation of the new bastard Empire of Caris had been only a single, inevitable step, in Clayton's opinion, and he could not support it. But by the same token, he was quick and fierce to defend Caris, as opposed to the Church of Caris when tempers flared.